Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 113, where Pedro, Sarah, and Tom are examining the film A League of Their Own from 1992, directed by Penny Marshall, starring Gina Davis and Tom Hanks, and produced by Parkway Productions. In part one, we discussed how the movie portrayed the early days of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, a women's baseball league that ran from 1943 to 1954. In part two, we will consider the legacy of the league and what has happened in women's sports and the broader topic of gender equity since the 1950s. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. So we've talked about the movie, and in some ways, we've talked about how it is a work of fiction, but is supposed to at least provide a glimpse of the lived experience of the people who were part of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, as portrayed in A League of Their Own. But I think it's worth taking a step back and looking at the actual history of the league, because the end of the movie, I think, has what I've considered to be my most favorite part, which is not Hollywood drama in the traditional sense. The very beginning of the movie starts with a grandmother who is being pushed along to go attend this big reunion, and she doesn't want to go. It doesn't take you long to figure out that this is the Gina Davis character, grown up, you know, some whatever it is, 35, 40 years later. And they really did a good job with the makeup on that regard. Fast forward all the way to the end, after the first season has played out in the film, now they go back to the reunion, and the grandmother shows up. And there she reunites with all of the players that are still alive, who were attending the reunion, who were Rockford Peaches. And it also includes reuniting briefly with a bunch of secondary characters who grew up. And they go around in the Cooperstown Hall of Fame that has an exhibit set up for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. You're shown pictures of, you know, basically it's a stylized, it's not a real exhibit. It is a set for the movie, but it includes a very realistic look at what such an exhibit would look like if they were showing the real people. So you had this big wall display with the Tom Hanks character, who had passed away several years earlier. And to me, that's all kind of touching, because it gets to an aspect of, it reminds me of organizational stories and how people especially people under either difficult, unusual, extraordinary conditions can build lasting bonds as young people that in some way carries them forward. Like, there has to be something so unique and special that brings you back to a reunion like this that you don't necessarily want to go to. And of course, we can almost read in that part of the reason that she doesn't want to go is because she misses it so much, and that it would be a deeply emotional time for her to go back, because she does show, you know, the character shows a lot of emotion as she's meeting all of these people. It's a very powerful scene, and it's reminiscent in so many other contexts, like why units who have come back from war have regular reunions, and it's a very powerful bond that people share over the course of their lives. Or others who were part of fire departments or police departments or any other sort of a high risk or high adventure, you know, whatever type of an organization it is, it's something that really, it can build a lifetime bond and bring people together who ordinarily would have just dispersed, and there you go.
But Google also has a very massive ex-Googler community. They maintain that as part of their identity, ex-Googler. I mean, a lot of Silicon Valley talks about where they have been, ex-employee of. But the ex-Googler community support each other, invest in each other, marry each other, rehire each other. And it's almost a workplace benefit on the assumption that you might not be there forever. The massive network of ex-Googlers is almost a workplace benefit. So I think maybe we make a small distinction between the examples you brought up, which are official reunions with this specific purpose in mind and based on the context those were in versus the identity you carry from a place, from an organization at a time. I think maybe, you know, the official versus the unofficial part of it.
The unofficial certainly people carry, and it's interesting to talk about technology, right? Because it's such a space in which the bonds are not ever understood to be lifetime. And I was thinking about the experience of my own mother, and, you know, she worked in IT, and she was, she usually says, and my dad also says, you know, they started when the computers were big, like entire rooms, right? And her first job was in a bank in the northeast of Brazil. And for many, many years after the bank closed down, the people that had worked in the IT department would still meet, and they have a Facebook group that is still active and all sorts of networks. So just an example on how this sort of imprint can be so powerful on people. And it's also something we see in any kind of more long-term kind of established organization, you know, retired clubs for employees or ex-employees in this case are also very common, right? So it's interesting to think about this aspect of organizations, right, that can intermingle with the professional life, right, so much. I also think it's interesting to think in terms of history and the past, because people who do studies exactly about the use of the past in organizations and memory and so on. And it's interesting that we were talking about how a change on our idea about who can do what job, or in this case, play what sport. It's also about the change in the discourse and understanding and perception. And something like a museum, right, and an exhibit can have an important role in educating, bringing forward, showcasing, and also inspiring to some extent, and showing what is the work it took and what the work it takes, and how it's important to recognize and praise effort to go in that direction, right? So the educational power of remembering, I think, is also brought forward in the way the narrative is constructed, with, you know, it ending once these people come together again to see the exhibit and see all of these stories represented and told that particular fashion.
Yeah, and also, you know, another thing about the league is that it really did have a strong impact on the futures of a number of its players. I did read that large numbers of players went on to get advanced educational degrees. Quite a number became doctors, business leaders. I mean, for many of them, a very appreciable number of them at least, being part of that league was a big stepping stone in their life. You know, yes, between Dottie and Kit, the younger sister, you had the contrast between the one who was very eager to get back to where she came from and resume the former life, and others who would want to go forward. And it was apparently a pretty good split in reality with a lot of the players. And regardless of which path they took, many of them were successful on the basis of their experience from being part of the league, which is why I think it provided such a powerful magnet for rejuvenating conversations about women's team sports. Because after the league folded in 1954 due to financial difficulties, women's team sports just almost dropped off the map. We were onto something, and then it just disappeared for decades afterwards. And interestingly enough, one of the reasons why it disappeared was because the leadership of the league was at the point of wanting to look for ways to integrate the women's baseball with men's baseball, to try to find ways for women to join, to make entry into the men's space, even at a minor league level. And that just was too much for the time. You know, the old arguments about defeminizing women sort of dissipated initially, but then in the 1950s, when attitudes in the U.S. became a bit more conservative or traditional, then this move of integration turned the whole thing on its head. It actually contributed to the demise of the league, because it was after around that time. Part of it was because they were getting new owners in with new ideas. And so all of this turmoil is what eventually led to its demise. And we wouldn't see women's professional team sports, at least not in the United States, at any grand scale, probably until women's basketball became a big deal in the 1990s, with the women's game in college becoming prominent, and then the establishment of some professional leagues. And now we have the Women's National Basketball Association, which is a very well-established women's league. But it's it took a very long time to be able to get to that point.
Can I ask you, Tom, with your expert hat on, so the league, the baseball league we're discussing, as you said, ran until 1954. And that means that it ran the duration of the Korean War as well, which is 1950 to 1953. So can I ask what you know, if anything, about how the league survived during the Korean War, the discussions about girls playing while boys were away and what would happen to them when they came back, and those differences? Because I think you're right to bring up the changing nature of life in the 50s, the rising economic comfort and future for Americans, and what that would mean, and the changing gender roles and changing opportunities. But I, now, it doesn't matter the number of times I've seen this film, I still completely forgot that it lasted over the Korean War. The league lasted over the Korean War. So many of the things we brought up happened again. And I just don't know what you know. So chop me down a little bit there and pass the ball to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't really know, but I can say this. In other men's sports leagues were impacted by World War II in a similar fashion. So, you know, I'm in Pennsylvania, and one of the famous things that happened during World War II was that the Pittsburgh Steelers merged with another team. For one season, they merged with the St. Louis Cardinals, and another season they merged, or was it Chicago? I forget. The Cardinals, whatever they were, wherever they were at the time. And they merged with the Philadelphia Eagles for a season because of a dearth of players. None of that happened in the Korean War. The Korean War life kind of, I think there was a lot less of an impact on the home front than it was in World War II. So I did not see the Korean War really mentioned in any of the histories of the girls' baseball league that that had much of a role. So I think pretty much at that point, it was just on its own and suffered from its own business decisions than anything else.
Another contribution to the prompt of why did we need to start a new organization that I would like us to noodle on is the role of statistics. Sports statistics in general is a very big field, and betting on sports and the statistics we have about betting is also a rich data source, of which baseball has more statistics than anybody else. So I'm speaking directly to this community when I provoke or prompt a discussion here. Is it possible that we needed to create the separate girls' league for the risk that the men's records would then stay intact? And let me tell you what I have in mind here. So there is a piece of the film, at least twice, where they discuss Jimmy's contributions to the game, his number of home runs over 400, his number of World Series championships, his number of world runs in World Series. And it's almost like his introduction and calling card, the 400-plus home run hitter, Jimmy Dugan. But the other thing that's on my mind was about where the player, and I give you this background, Pedro, when the integration of white and non-white baseball, men's baseball leagues, and whether those players could play together. And there was a discussion for a very famous player named Roger Maris and his home run record that is forever now reproduced with an asterisk next to it, 61 star. And there was even a film made called 61 Star, which is a compromise way of representing his place in the history books. Let's summarize a very big topic by saying that. And it was fascinating to me of how they made that compromise and how it was adopted by the sport and by the stats fans. And that was for a single male versus male competition. So we've talked before about tennis and the battle of the sexes, Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs. And I'm wondering whether the one of the motivations, subtle or overt, I wasn't there, but one of the motivations for separating the women out into another league would potentially be those records and those heroes, the non-war heroes, as close as Americans get to heroes outside of wartime, is their sports players. And what happens to those heroes and those records if you get some really good girls?
Let me go ahead and put this in the contemporary context, because we just happen to be a few days removed from that very conversation, but in a totally different light. At the time of this recording, the United States college basketball championships were just finished being played. And the women and the men championship games are held back to back. The women, first off, if you were to name a college basketball player right now, it would the most recognized star, it would have been from one of the women's teams in the championship. And the women, their broadcast, they drew an audience of 4 million viewers more than the men's basketball game. And last year, the same thing had happened. And there was a lot of discussion about, from a sports business standpoint, could we really compare the viewing statistics and some of these other statistics between the men's and the women's games? Or are they really just, it's one venue, it's one thing? When it comes to records, it's interesting because it isn't just a matter of between men's and women's leagues. It's also between when, say, a major league absorbs another league, which has happened in the past. Do you keep the records of the league you absorbed, or you dispense with them? And we've seen that sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. The decision to or not do it has a great impact on where the players stand coming in from the former league. So yeah, all of these are very interesting discussions about what it really means. What do the statistics really mean? We love them so much, but we are in the end comparing a whole fruit salad. Apples, oranges, bananas, etc., of different situations based on what we're counting and what we're choosing not to count. It's assumed to be a business decision.
So I don't watch sports much, so that's not where my head went. Where it went was on something you're just talking about now, Tom, about counting and quantification, right? And we know from research that quantification, rankings, and all of that, they kind of erase qualitative distinctions, and metaphorically, everything becomes measurable by weight. And all of this is making me think that there is a long history of quantification and how we think about work or professionals and even ourselves through such homogenizing and homogeneous type of criteria in thinking of someone in terms of the number of home runs a person has. You know, it's related to this abstract general criteria in they have just become much, 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 much more salient, right? Because with digitalization and many other changes has made possible to think from restaurants to doctors to any sort of space, profession, situation, experience through ratings, through evaluations, and through quantification, right? So it's interesting to see. Well, at least I'm superimposing this interpretation in seeing how we think about one's work and worth through those lenses and seeing how there is a longer history to what we usually think about, because we usually see that in relation to digitalization.
Yeah, now it's salient. It's definitely salient if we were to just blindly look at the women's statistics, you know, from the girls' professional baseball league of that time to the men. And you would see differences, different levels when it came to things like batting averages, which were much lower in the women's game. Home runs, triples, you know, some of the big power statistics that we think of, you know, that are very attractive to baseball fans, they were lower in the women's game. So if you were to just look at the raw numbers without really contextualizing them, it would be very easy for somebody to perhaps wrongly conclude that the women's game was in some way inferior. And I think that that kind of conversation often comes up when it comes to comparing women's sports with men's sports. Having watched quite a lot of women's basketball and comparing it to men's basketball, I can say for myself, it is my view that women play a much more effective tactical game than men do. And that's in part because they're taking the skills, you know, what skills, what strengths, what vulnerabilities that they have in the women's game, and they work around it by using far greater movement, passing, you know, different skills. Whereas the men, it remains much more of a power game. It always has been much more of a power game. You know, it's always dangerous to try to get into games with the statistics. And I think what people are paying more attention to nowadays with the help of technology is not what the raw statistics are, but what are trends? How do we put the numbers together to try to decide what is a person's true strength? What are their true tendencies? If you know somebody's tendencies, you might be better positioned to defend against it, for example. So it's much, much more elaborate. And it's almost making me think maybe somewhere along the line, we should put Moneyball on our list of movies to review in future years.
Well, women's soccer versus men's soccer also follows that pattern that you're raising. So over time, soccer has become a lower and lower scoring game. Full times, overtime, and much lower scores. But I'm pretty sure I'm not speaking out of turn to say women's matches average more goals. Or at least certainly I know they average more. I know for sure they average more attempts on goal, which is what makes the game exciting compared to men's game on a global level. I'm talking about. So I find that makes sense. It resonates for me with other team sports that you were talking about as well.
Yeah, and there we're talking just a general challenge with soccer, period, aren't we? We can't forget the consumer. I mean, you know, we have to think about what it is about a particular sport that makes it enjoyable for people to watch, because there are those who can sit through an entire 0-0 final and think that that was an absolutely fantastic game, and then you have a lot of American fans who just will never think that way, I suppose.
I was going to ask about what you thought about the role of television for the consumer and televised sports, but I just had a quick look at when was the first televised baseball game. Would you believe 1939? I did not know it was that early. Doubleheader between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds at Ebbets Field. Unbelievable. Pedro says TV, so let's maybe go back to your point about sports and the consumer and say, of course, maybe you can transition and say, of course, we need to make a distinction between the on-site consumer and the global consumer of it.
There is something to be said, too, about the... I did neglect to mention that television did potentially contribute to the decline of the girls' professional baseball league, at least, again, based on what I was reading. And that's because the advent of television before that, of course, it was heavily on in-person attendance and radio broadcasts and things like that. And so then with national television is really the main thing, the ability to broadcast a baseball game across the country. It made it more possible to be followers of big baseball teams from anywhere within the country. It wasn't just about your local team anymore. And that made the women's game or the women's league even that much less attractive. Now we see whole sports leagues, whole sports being defined and whatever, built around television out front. As it's just an assumed part of it that if you don't have television, you don't have anything. You don't have a product. I mean, it's really changed.
So I also went in a different direction here because I thought in terms of how in the movie, there's a lot of debate on the role of the media and the press, right? And exactly this inflection point in which there is not a lot of attendance. And then there is, you know, one of the players, I think is the character of Dottie, Jaina Davis, does a sort of a split, right? In the middle of trying to reach a base, right? Something like that. I don't know the lingo. And that is kind of, there's a picture taken at his front page, and there's like, you know, different things that the women start to do in order to get attention, and the media picks that up, and that picks attendance. So it's interesting to see. Again, we live in such a connected, mediatized, digitalized kind of instantaneous communication world, to think in terms of the role that print media, the role of communication, of radio, had in diffusing ideas, shaping people's understandings, you know, informing the public discourse, in this case, you know, making the idea of women's sport more interesting, relevant, acceptable, legitimate somehow.
And there's an interesting parallel to that. So there's a scene in the film where the women sneak out of their chaperoned dormitory for the night to attend a dance at a roadhouse. So being a highway side bar for all comers, and they drink and they dance and they sing, and some of them make romantic attachments. And it's fascinating to watch that with a 2024 lens and to think, thank goodness they had no one who could report on them. Because they know for sure their contractual the conditions were, if they were caught doing anything, what would now would be called a morality clause, right? No drinking, no smoking, no men, no doing anything unladylike. And they did all of those in the single evening, in the single environment. And yet, it's not that there was no media. There was nothing stopping any of those gentlemen taking their nickel out of their pocket and using a public payphone to ring a reporter and inform on them. Or let's say a corporate espionage, that a spy from the other team noticed that the women were misbehaving, because they're all going to the same match, and reported on the other team. And then they had to forfeit the game and rebuild the team. So it's not that there was no ability to get caught or no ability to be documented. It's that I think media consumers' priorities changed. And as Tom mentioned already before, the need to put out a positive story from home to abroad, you know, certainly the league would be motivated to hide those behaviors if they ever found them. There would probably be a league fixer following the women around and cleaning it up. But in a more positive example, as you raised, the players did lean into Mr. Lowenstein's direct marketing activities. So there's a montage of things like catch a foul ball and get a kiss, right? So the idea of filling the stadiums with people hoping to catch a foul ball and get one of the pretty players to give them a kiss. There's a pitching competition, you know, three of the players throw the balls at targets at once to see if they win. There's things done around the game and in the dead time in the game, the seventh inning stretch being the most famous of that, that are done to make it, to market it. It's marketing. I mentioned before some of the ones that are, that the women resist in the beginning and then lean into when they realize that their jobs are on the line. And I find that decision individually and collectively to stop the values campaign, let's say, to stop the united front against it. And that parallels Jimmy's ongoing conversation with Dottie about, is she really a player? And is this really baseball? And only if they act like men and play like the men do they get considered players versus girls, right? They're not women. So we have the women's NBA. We have women's Major League Soccer. But in this case, we had All-American girls baseball, not women's baseball. So if you think about that in the role of media, obviously we have the film that we're centering our discussion around here, but we can look archivally at the almost quiet agreement to support this effort and make it work and not include any of the bad parts. However, there is an example of girl-on-girl physical fighting, a physical conflict that also attracts media attention. I think that's the sole example of the situation portrayed negatively. So we can use our 2024 lens and look backwards, or we can suspend our disbelief and put ourselves contemporaneously and consider what the role of the media was then.
Well, yeah, and this is where you wonder, okay, so how much is how much is Hollywood and how much is lived experience through a Hollywood lens? And it's tough to tell because what has been published, which isn't actually all that much about this league, doesn't really suggest that there was a lot of that nonsense going on, that there wasn't a lot of fisticuffs. It was actually a rather calm, ordinary affair. You know, the games were not unruly. They didn't actually have a lot of any of the same bad behaviors that were seen in men's baseball at the time. It wasn't that far removed from the days when umpires used to be assaulted by fans. So, there's a whole history of baseball that we don't want to bring into this.
But you're right, because that's an example of the women players being held to a higher standard than the male players. I know you've talked about physical developmental differences and accommodations in the design of the sport for those differences. So things like a shorter field, shorter infield distances, different balls, different durations of the matches, etc., which were adjustments to make the game and the experience of going to a game almost the same. And so you could almost forget that there were women playing and not men. But throughout the film, there are examples where you can identify the women players being held to a higher standard than men, and not just within the morality clause, because we know policing of women's morality is throughout history. So I'm not just talking about how come the women are not allowed to have a drop of alcohol and Jimmy's always drunk. Like that's not what I mean. I mean things like performance standards, self-presentation, behavior, comportment we've discussed, but also things like, for example, there are multiple times where he complains about them being late. And even all the way to the end during the World Series, packing the bus, he says, it's almost like you're physically incapable of being on time. And if you don't think you need the extra batting practice, think again. Now, we could say that's an example of him finally looking like a coach and thinking about their professional development, which is what we wanted from him the rest of the film. But I think that's a stronger example of standards of punctuality, preparedness, being higher for the women players. And there's a part of me that wonders whether if that continued the next 11 years or 10 more seasons after the one that was dramatized here, if there's a certain impossibility to it or an inevitability that we will get there. It reminds me a lot of the glass cliff effect, hiring women to positions where they for sure can't be successful, just so that we can say, we tried, we hired a woman, she couldn't do it, she failed, we'll go back to hiring men. And we can put that resource attached to this for anyone who's not familiar with it. But I wonder somewhat if in the design there were those features that tend towards unreasonable expectations and higher standards.
I think some of the portrayal in the movie was just simply trying to make the film relatable to what was the present day of the 1990s and the issues of women's punctuality. I think that may have been somewhat of a joke. Certainly, something along that line was why they had the Tom Hanks, Jimmy Dugan, deliver the most famous line in the movie. There's no crying in baseball, as a way of exemplifying what was perceived to be the greatest of gender differences between an in-your-face, foul, aggressive, hyper-masculine male baseball figure and a emotional, insecure female character. How much of that was played up or to make the movie relatable as opposed to whether anything like that happened in real life, I guess we'll just have to wait for the documentary.
So from impossible standards to possible skills, because as maybe a non-expert in baseball, there is a lot of debate on in which position you play and what skill you have and who is a pitcher or whatever. So I was wondering a little bit about specialization and staffing of roles. And in the scouting, there is some discussion about that, right? So you're good at this or that, and what can you play? I don't know. I was just like trying to see if you folks who know more about baseball had a reading on what the different positions and the skills and who gets to play in what position and how you develop one or the other, tell something about the story as well.
Yeah, I can at least start on that. I mean, and this also just gets into an interesting discussion about just about any sport, because each sport, there's different degrees to which you have particular positions have not just physical skills, but which positions are in the ipso facto leadership mode. Okay. The most obvious example of that being in American football with the quarterback, who is the leader of the offense and who also happens to have to be one of the most skilled players on the team. In no way saying that nobody else has to be skilled. It's an incredibly skilled game. And in baseball, the positions are so clearly defined based on where you are. Like, it's really hard to move around the baseball diamond. If you show that you can be a good catcher, you are pretty much going to be a catcher. If you're a pitcher, you're pretty much going to be a pitcher. Maybe you can move a little bit around the infield, but usually first basemen tend to be first basemen. Maybe the others will switch around a little bit. The outfield is probably the most malleable. It is so specialized that you really do have to assemble a team, or which is to say a appropriate mix of specialty players. You have to have a certain number of pitchers. And now, even within pitching, of course, it's gotten so special, so incredibly specialized, such that, you know, you track, because there are several different types of pitches. And we measure, you know, whether somebody, based on which pitches they throw, whether they start a game, pitch in the middle of the game, or they're one of the ones who pitch at the end. And the degree of specialization, is it a good or a bad thing? I don't know. Some people seem to like it, but it certainly adds to the intrigue of the game, because then as the coach or the manager is having to weigh so many variables, trying to decide what to do at any particular time, who to substitute for whom, when, on the basis of a rather dizzying array of statistics based on the physical skills that they have. So it is truly a numbers game.
Also, in terms of our discussion of developing within your profession, that hyperspecialization means that there isn't really any room to grow. The only real movement would be, at the time, if you improved your game, you would move in from the outfield to the infield. But actually, outfield has its own specialization in long distance throwing to target. So each of the roles has something that they do that nobody else does. And as we talked earlier about future, and I think this relates to the conversations we've had in other episodes about future proofing. In general, in professional sports, the coaching, the use of data, sports physiology, getting closer to medicine, you know, the knowledge of the body as machine means that, for example, in tennis, the speed of serves is getting to numbers that people never thought were humanly possible before, as well as the technology to track them has gotten better, so they are more accurate. And those two things are happening at the same time. That's also true of hitting and pitching in baseball. The rest of the game hasn't changed that much, but the two core skills that are what we focus on. So then the question becomes, well, what is development and what is professional development and whose responsibility is it? With many professional sports, the limit to the career is the limit of your body. And there are very few star players, and they are stars both before and after this fact, but there are very few star players who have enduring careers and long-term careers compared to, especially in baseball, you know, the starting age is so low and the strength so high from such a young age, as well as injuries over the career course. You know, so these are all things that sports career management takes into account, you know, but your body is your tool. And this is the same at Olympic level, right? So the commitment, we're in an Olympic year. I wanted to talk about that a bit as well, what happens in an Olympic summer Olympics year. But the professionalization of sports for Olympians as well is a certain amount of time based on the health and the strength of your body. And then the question is, so what? Or so what next? This is one thing I think where actually there might not have been a gender difference in this case, because for the women in our film, or the women in this league, besides injury, the other way out was marriage and pregnancy. But at that point in history, that's true of every profession that women were in. Many were limited early by marriage and pregnancy, whereas that was expected and a hopeful outcome for the all-American girls. So professional development takes on a really different meaning, and whose responsibility is it, and who is creating programs for professional development change when you're talking about the body.
Now, another thing I think is worth mentioning is that professional development now seems to be movement from on-field to off-field. The coaching staff itself has become a much larger organization in most sports, or more extensive than before. So now there's opportunities that once your playing career is over, but you still want to be part of the game, there are roles for you. And there are plenty of opportunities, whether it's scouting, whether it's coaching, whether it's moving up to general managership, marketing. There's something that definitely wasn't heard of before. You have players now who become owners of sport. They become so powerful that they are buying sports teams. They're doing pretty good. And another thing that's interesting too, as we're talking about women, is we're now starting to see women, you know, not just did we have men's coaches on women's teams, we're starting to see women being coaches, playing prominent roles in men's sports teams. And it's no big deal, not an issue. And I think that's going to continue. So in a way, you know, there's a recognition that everybody's playing career is finite. And there does need to be, for many of them, an opportunity to go on to something bigger and better. And if it's within the sport, that's fine. But there is also kind of a dark side, which I know we're starting to really move away from the movie, but there are some sports and significant numbers of athletes who suffer physically in ways where they really have difficulty being able to go in a post-sports life. And that's also being much more widely recognized, which is now why we see so much concern about head injuries, joints, heart issues. So the sports world is a much, much more complicated. And I think it needs to be, because we're starting to measure sports and sports people beyond their on-field characteristics. What they do off the field is that much more a part of who they are and as part of our expectations for them. They're public figures. And it's sort of bringing it back full around to the movie. We can see how the treatment of them as public figures put them in a very strange direction, as trying to tell people to be something that they're not.
So bringing this back to managed organizations, it seems that, from what I understand, the character of Tom Hanks would today be an ensemble cast in itself, right? Because we don't get to see exactly all the different roles that are played that have a coaching function or a management function that made the team go on. And this was kind of making me think of Taylorism, right? The idea that it's not just the manager, but the managing principle is supported by, in this that case, engineers and all the people that were looking at efficiency gains and task design and coordination and so on, right? That would exist based on, you know, all types of analysis. And of course, in today, given technology, given medicine, given all of this, let's say, entry of professional specialists into this debate in order to enhance and improve the health of the sports people, their skills and ability, and so on, right? You can imagine that there is a bigger role for a variety of roles exactly in supporting the work at sports.
I mean, yes, it was a movie. I mean, and we have to look at it through that lens that, you know, a lot of the situations were played up to generate emotional response and to get behind what were, you know, the important characters of the movie. But I think it really did provide a good venue for looking at the lived experience of an episode of a particular sports situation that was so unique and so little understood in terms of its impact. It succeeded in that ground. I mean, its purpose very clearly was to try to tell a relatable story about such an extraordinary experience that would have been left to the dustbin of history if not for this movie.
So Tom, let's hear your answer to your own thought prompt. why do you think they needed to create a new organization? Or what did the new organization achieve?
Yeah, and those are two very different questions. The need, there probably wasn't one. In the end, there probably wasn't a need. There probably wasn't anything to worry about. But because baseball was so heavily institutionalized, it was such an inherent part of the social fabric, the fear of losing it was palpable. And so finding anything, I mean, they would have figured out if there was a way to have baseball, like to promote Little League into something, they probably would have done it that way. But this is what they chose. Anything to keep it on the front, you know, to keep it from losing visibility. Sorry, your second question again.
What do you think it achieved? So the first one was about why was it set up and why was it needed? And then the other end is, okay, whether you thought it was necessary or not, what did it achieve?
Well, considering that when women team sports became a subject of conversation starting from the late 70s, when the first inklings of an idea of a women's basketball league was being floated that I can recall, they were going back to this women's baseball league. Ordinary society might have put it on the back burner or forgotten about it, but a lot of women athletes didn't. You know, after Title IX and after all this other, you know, discussions about women's sports becoming more prominent, without having had the success of that league, I think it would have even been more difficult to get any movement.
My final reflection is, I mean, first of all, sign me up for anything with Madonna on. But more broadly, I think that the movie kind of posed the questions, you know, and make us think of something like, whose jobs are these? It's a sort of question that someone like Lisa Cohen, who was in our podcast before in an episode about jobs and tasks, examines, and many others as well. It's something we talked about in our gender organization episode with Summer Jackson. Well, the movie shows that it is always a product of social understandings, media debate, social relations, right? So who can do some kind of work and what we value and how we value that is enmeshed in historical situations, right? And it's always, in the case of walking towards equality, an effort that is not just the actual doing of the work, but also all of the other things that go around it, right? Which makes exactly understanding work and organization so important through a social lens.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.